Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers' Festival. You're listening to a podcast recorded live at the 2019 Festival.
G'day everyone, and welcome to the Sydney Writers' Festival. My name is Benjamin Law. We're all very pleased to be here with you today on Gadigal land. First Nations Australians like the Gadigal of the Great Eora Nation, which encompasses the Sydney Basin, have been telling stories and sharing information and sharing knowledge here for tens of thousands of years, together making the oldest surviving and continuing civilizations on the planet. And we are very grateful to elders past, present and future that we get to continue telling stories here on Aboriginal land. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander writers are also telling, of course, some of our most important and urgent stories right now. And in the festival, we're so lucky to have the likes of Melissa Lukashenko, Tony Birch, Alison Whittaker, Stan Grant, Nanyuka Gorry, and so many other First Nations writers in the festival. So make sure you see them. Also, a shout out to the original hosts. I'm the third pick for today. Original hosts Jamila Rizvi and Marnie Cordell, who are unwell and couldn't moderate today. We hope that you get well soon. We're going to talk about something today that's a little bit taboo at the Sydney Writers' Festival, this celebration of a very analog technology, the book. We are going to discuss the internet, which is just a really beautiful thing, generally, isn't it? Remember when the internet was invented? Suddenly we were able to communicate globally in an instant, upload and exchange the entirety of humanity's knowledge in real time. And surely, with this porousness and exchange of ideas, would come a new dawn and a bright age of human discourse. No. We are also seeing simply online spaces resulting in people, especially women, especially minorities, subject to new, hideous, and sometimes diabolically creative forms of abuse and harassment. And if your job is someone to engage in the public sphere, engaging and disseminating ideas can be a dangerous thing. Today's guests are three reporters who have each been subjected to volumes of online trolling and in their own ways have also discussed, examined and interrogated the rise of cyber hate. They'll share their stories, examine the mindset and motivations of cyber bullies, discuss the rise of doxing, which is publishing private information about somebody, and reflect on a cohort of mostly angry young white men who have emerged from websites like 4chan and Reddit to spread their animus in increasingly coordinated ways. So a lovely light way to start your Saturday, everyone. Our first guest next to me is a Sydney-based journalist, producer, and writer who has contributed to Crikey, the ABC, The Guardian, Vice, The Australian, News Local, and as a young Palestinian woman, also covered national security for The Australian, which is a very dynamic combination. Please welcome Janine Kallick. Next to Janine, we've got the deputy editor of ABC Life and a former news editor for Junkie Media. He regularly presents on ABC News' culture and arts program, The Mix, and has worked on ABC's award-winning investigative journalism program, Background Briefing. He was also subjected to doxing, where your personal details are shared online, and we'll be talking about that today. Please welcome Osman Faruqi. And finally, next to Osman, we've got an award-winning social justice journalist from Canberra. She wrote a series of articles on trolling for Fairfax newspapers in 2017. And her book, Troll Hunting, is a deep dive into the world of online hate and its human fallout, both from the victims and the trolls' perspective. Please welcome Ginger Gorman. Now, Osman, I might start with you because your abuse and cases actually became quite public in their own way. So I'll just do a recap for people. Your mobile phone number was shared online by a far-right activist by the name of Avi Yemeni. You were bombarded with abusive and racist phone calls and text messages. And you made a radio program for Background Briefing about your experience. So can you tell us a little bit about what happened and why you wanted to investigate and lean into that experience in your own work?
Sure. I mean, I'll try and save some of the gory details because they're a bit gory, but I basically was the target of a group of far-right agitators online, orchestrated by one particular individual who was not happy with the fact that I worked at the ABC, that I was a migrant, that I had a Muslim background, and he found my mobile phone number, shared it on his Facebook page that had tens of thousands of followers, and encouraged them to call me up and let me know what they thought about me. That resulted in days of vile text messages, phone calls, people threatening to kill me. I was very scared. I'd been the subject of cyber bullying, cyber trolling, online abuse before. If you're active on social media, if you're a journalist, if you're a woman journalist, if you're a journalist who's a person of color, all that stuff is familiar to you. But having someone call you up felt quite different. It felt like something that was just consigned to the realms of the internet was now part of the real world. And that episode set me off on this journey, I guess, which ended with my background briefing investigation, where I explored what cyber trolling is, the links between the online world, the real world, and whether or not there are things that we being society, individuals, the government, police, can do to actually push back on what goes on. One of the clearest takeaways for me was we now live in an era where I think the term cyber trolling doesn't quite accurately represent what's going on. And I mean that in two parts. I think the cyber or online element is almost irrelevant now. There may have been a time where the internet was a distinct thing separate to how we live and breathe and live our lives, but that's not the case anymore. I mean, we used to talk about e-banking and, you know, paying our bills using this fancy new technology called the internet, but that's just... And even email is like electronic mail, but you know, we don't really send hard copy posts anymore. The internet has become a primary medium in how we live our lives. Mm. So I think almost by referring to hate and adding that descriptor at the start that it's cyber or online, it kind of pretends that it happens in this vague land over there.
As if the virtual space isn't the real world.
That you can just switch off from it. And you know, I remember when I went to the police and told them what had happened, they said, oh, just, you know, block these people on Facebook or, you know, try not to go on the internet. And I'm like, it's 2018. In what world can I not go on the internet? Mm. I'm a working journalist. And look, there was one particular story about one particular cyber troll, for lack of a better term at the moment, that I think illustrates the predicament that we're in. And this particular cyber troll is a young Australian man. He's still around. He was a member of a number of far-right Facebook groups and Reddit forums. He was active on groups like 4chan and 8chan, where the far-right mobilize, where they share ideas, where they pick their targets and go out and attack these people and attack their targets. He, in 2016, made a death threat to a person on Facebook using his real name. That death threat was reported to the police. The police chose not to investigate and advised the victim to just block that individual on Facebook. That individual on March 15th this year walked into two mosques in Christchurch and killed 50 people. The oldest victim was 77. The youngest victim was 3 years old. And the purpose of that story is not to say that every single person who sends a death threat online or is involved in online far-right activism is going to do and commit a massacre, but we live in a world now where these things are linked and we can't pretend that they're not. The Pittsburgh synagogue shooting that left 11 people dead, the perpetrator of that had been posting anti-Semitic and violently anti-Semitic posts online. The shooter in the most recent synagogue shooting in California had been involved in the same far-right online web spaces as the Christchurch shooter. These things are happening on the internet, but they're reflective of something that's happening in society. And I think whilst the internet element of it exposes it and we can see it more obviously, and whilst we might need specific laws and processes to deal with specifically what happens on the internet, I think it's really just scratching the surface and it's a much bigger issue across society that we're grappling with.
Mm. Thanks, Oz. Let's park it there because you're bringing up two things that I want to explore later in the session. And one is what's at stake. And I think we've seen through incidents like Christchurch exactly what is at stake. And the second thing is the capacity for organisations and agencies to deal with that stuff. So let's return to that. Before we do, Janine, for you, online harassment has very much transferred into real life in some ways. You were followed on a job by some members of an organisation or group who were taking photos of you. You had to go out with a security guard just to do your reporting in some instances. What happened?
Yeah, so prefacing this particular story. Sorry, I'm a bit ill. I obviously receive very sort of multifaceted trolling and abuse online. So it's sexist and it's racist, and it can come from white supremacists. It can come from people who disagree with my identity as a Palestinian who really owns it.
So essentially just being who you are
existing,
in a digital space is going to attract that.
So I used to work at The Australian for 2 years when I was a younger journo, and I ended up in the crime and court reporting beats, and I also covered a few national security stories. Now, it wasn't like a national security beat, but they were of national significance. And there was this one, I think it was a few weeks into the job, a young man who had gone to Syria was killed by a US drone strike. And so the ABC had broken that story, and I was still at in the newsroom in the evening, and it was sort of like the wires are reporting it, ABC just broke it, put together a story for the next day's paper. And I did, and it was just a straight news story. We had the person's name and just the circumstances, they were under and what organization they were with. So it's an organization that's sort of just one of the rebel factions, an Islamic rebel faction that's tangential to Islamic State. And I just thought, publish the story, and the furor that came within from, certain sections, certain vocal people from, I guess, my community, you could say.
What community are you talking about?
Well, I hate to say Muslim community because it's so diverse and it's not homogenous at all. There are some, organized parts of it. And there was just a lot of anger about the fact that I had reported on this, despite it being straight reporting. And so a few things happened that led to me being followed on a job. I started receiving death threats. People found family members on Facebook and they started messaging them saying, tell your daughter to watch her back. There was a few Facebook groups for people within those communities to kind of just discuss philosophical, religious, community issues. And I was part of the group. I'm not practicing that. I identify culturally as Muslim, just to make that disclaimer. And so I was removed from the group, fair enough. And someone had posted something about me going to a mosque, wearing a mini skirt, and I was sweet-talking men at the mosque, apparently. And so when people saw that, that just compounded it. There was so much anger. A complete lie, a total rumor. And even if I did rock up, it doesn't deserve. I mean, it's disproportionate.
But essentially, what was happening was, it sounds like an orchestrated campaign. It wasn't just individuals going after you and critiquing the work that you had put out there as a reporter.
Yeah.
It sounds like something was organized.
Yeah, I mean, there were a few people, and again, I say it was a vocal number of people within that sort of, quote unquote community that really had sort of beef, and they obviously knew each other, and so it just got bigger, and it ended up with some from a particular organization. These three big guys just followed me onto a job once, and then were just taking photos of me.
What do you think their ultimate goal was?
To intimidate me, just to say, it wasn't even with their phone. It was that they came prepared with a DSLR and just to pap me in a way, not in the glamorous sense. So that happened, and I was just, it was one of the most excruciating times. I was just so anxious, constantly watching my back.
And this sounds like it was a particular era of your professional life, but has that continued in any way to even now?
Yeah, it has, but I've backed off a bit. So if my name was Jane Smith, for example, if I had reported on that particular story, and this is just one example. I mean, I cop so much from different groups.
Yeah.
So I don't want to be excluding or just highlighting one group, and we can get into it a bit later. Once I sort of started backing off a bit, and I actually took up a relocation in Queensland because I was like, I need to get away from all... Because I worried. I was living with my family at the time, and I was watching my back constantly, just catching the train and going to get my car from the station to go home. I just every like movement freaked me out because I thought somebody would be following me and taking photos. So I went interstate and I covered regional issues and did the crime beat in Queensland, which is totally, you know, different to the one here. And that's how I had to physically remove myself.
It changed the course of what
Absolutely.
You were doing and how you were doing
yeah.
it. Okay. Yeah. Ginger, let's go to you for a minute because you have definitely had your own experiences with trolling, which you've spoken about quite candidly before. But I want to talk about what happened afterwards because rather than running away from those experiences, I mean, similarly to what Osman did with his background briefing, you leaned into this phenomenon and you wanted to interrogate it, you wanted to explore it. What did you want to explore and what were the questions that you were bringing in?
Well, I think from what both Osman and Janine are saying, you can see that the impacts of trolling are very real life. And in fact, you know, there's some really real life violence that's occurs in my book where, for example, you know, there's a journalist in there who's a campaigner and her dog gets given acid, her horse gets killed as a result of cyber hate. So what we need to understand is that these things are very real life. And I guess having experienced the cold fear of getting a death threat and wondering if my kids were going to get killed, and then also seeing really similar things happening to my colleagues. So at the time I was working for the ABC, there were death threats, people were getting rape threats, pictures of beheaded women in their inbox boxes, they were having to move house. So I was trying to understand, you know, at some point after the fear died down of this huge campaign of hatred against me and my family, I really just wanted to know, like, why would you do that? Why would you send someone that you don't know a death threat or a rape threat or make them so afraid that they have to move house? And similar stuff was happening in the States, I noticed. So it wasn't just that it was a couple of Australian journos. It was really very widespread. I did something that in retrospect is so naive. I just put a call out to meet these guys. I was like, I want to meet some really dangerous committed trolls, you know. And I mean, let's be clear about this now. Like, my book links trolling to terrorism, to murder, to incitement to suicide, to real life stalking, to lots and lots of very serious crimes. I didn't know what I was getting into. And I mean, I've been talking to trolls for a couple of years when I went to write the book, but I did not understand how dangerous they were. I mean, when I went to meet Mark, who is one of the scariest trolls in my book, I just turned up to a hotel with a recorder, you know? Now, he incites people to suicide. He should be in jail. But they are not all the same, but there are some things we can say about them. So there's huge diversity in trolling. It's not necessarily men or women. Most of the trolls in my book, though, are young white men, and they are very angry. They're kind of your classic, almost Trump supporter sort of guy. And
what are they angry about? What are they angry about?
Look, it was hard for me to wrap my head around as kind of a feminist, but they feel marginalised. They feel very unheard. Most of them come from incredibly damaged, neglectful backgrounds, violent backgrounds, and the internet has brought them up. So there's a chapter in my book called The Internet Was My Parent, and what it describes is these kids, 10 or 11 years old, sat on the internet, and the internet is their babysitter. And what's happening is they're on Reddit, 4chan, 8chan, the cesspits of the internet, and they are imbibing white supremacy, misogyny, and they get radicalized into trolling. So when the Christchurch massacre happened, I was waiting for this moment, and eventually that guy's grandmother, I won't name him, but his grandmother came out and said he was always alone on the internet from when he was a little kid, and I was like, yeah. The internet was his parent. They are not who you expect. They work in big international syndicates. They have presidents and vice presidents. They are very much like bikie gangs. They are organized. These are orchestrated crimes that they are doing. They often are incredibly educated. I became friends with one of the presidents of these big syndicates, so right-wing, Trump-loving, woman-hating, gun-loving, like my exact hate match. They hate people in mixed race marriages, they hate Jews, they hate journalists, they hate women. But once I started talking to them, they just would not shut up. And the reason they wouldn't shut up is because they feel unheard. Mm. Yeah, so they're angry, and Meepsheep, the president of this big trolling syndicate, said, when you're angry at the world and you feel like no one's ever listened to you and you meet this cohort of people online who seem to have the same values that you, you think you can get back at the world, and this is how you do it. Mm. So, yeah, it is actually terrifying. I mean, it's terrifying, but also they're humans as well.
Can we just take a step back, Ginger? I wouldn't mind going a little bit remedial for a second here, but all of us who work within the public space, we put out work that is subject to criticism, and sometimes that criticism is abusive, and then there is abuse itself, and then there is trolling. What are the delineations between all of those things, and at what point does a troll become a troll?
So Osman said a really important thing, and that is that we don't really have the language for this. So in my book, I talk about predator trolling, and that is really the extreme end where people are using the internet to do real-life harm, like the Christchurch massacre. But we need to see this as a spectrum. Like someone being a bit stupid online and doing a prank, that's at one end. Really violent comments that may or may not come to pass are kind of in the middle, and it moves right down to this extreme end. And frankly, as a society, we are completely lost with this. We don't have the language. If you turn up to the police station, so say there are women in my book who are subject to extreme predator trolling from their former partners. Their lives have been destroyed. It's domestic violence. And they turn up to the police station and say, I'm being trolled. And the police say, stay off the internet, love. Mm. You know, so there's a kind of loss of language. We don't have the language to describe it. We don't understand that this is a spectrum of behaviours, and it's stopping us solving the problem. But we need to understand that there are some very useful kinds of trolling. Like, some political trolling is very important.
What do you mean? What's political trolling?
Well, so, for example, some of the trolls in my book, they prank the media in a certain way, and they're trying to show up problems in the media, and it's actually funny and it's smart and it's brilliant.
What's an example of that?
Well, I mean, there are problems with the way that they do it sometimes, but so excuse me, this is very offensive, but there's a group in my book called, this is the name of the trolling syndicate, the Gay Niggers Association of America, and they've given the syndicate that name because when we report it in the media, we have to use this offensive name. And so they will do things like during Hurricane Sandy, they created all these black profiles of people on Twitter, fake ones, and they pretended that they were looting. And that their tweets were ludicrous. They were pretending that they were stealing people's cats and things and people's shirts. And it's very, very offensive. But the media reported it wholesale. The Daily Mail and so forth, 7 media outlets, major American media outlets, reported this as if it was happening. You know, there's these gangs of people looting. And what the Gay Niggers Association of America was trying to say, you're all racist in the media, you don't check your facts, and you are willing to report this wholesale. So they were actually showing up racial tropes in society, they were showing up problems in the media. And I mean, it's problematic, right? Because it does, I said, what if the product of that is that you're actually perpetrating
you're
racism?
You're kind of engineering racism to show.
But they were saying, we're not a white power group, we're trying to say you guys in the media are doing your jobs badly, and if you're going to not check your facts, you shouldn't have your jobs. Mm. And so whether or not you agree with what they did, it was quite clever, and I did actually sit around thinking, yeah, you know what? We are propagandists sometimes for certain things in the media. Mm. So it can be useful.
Well, let's talk, Osman, a little bit about the role that civic institutions are playing and not playing with this discussion. So whether it comes to the media, as Ginger's been talking about, when it comes to the government, when it comes to the police, I'm wondering whether after instances like Cronulla, after instances like Christchurch, whether those important institutions that are charged to protect us or represent us in certain ways have got a handle on this. What's your personal experience of that been, and how do you see this as a reporter?
Look, it's such a great question because, like, in a way, these groups that you're all talking about, they have at their core, particularly government and the police, a responsibility to protect us as citizens. But what I think we've seen post-Christchurch in particular is not only an abrogation of that responsibility, but in some ways an inflammation of the situation. And I might start with the media, actually, before I get into the government and police. The post-Christchurch, we saw a campaign from some sections of the media pushing for tighter regulation of social media, in particular Facebook, who they said were permitting and spreading these kinds of white supremacist ideas. And I think, look, there's no doubt that social media can be a force for good or bad depending on how it's being used. And I think there's no question that an organization like Facebook, which is so powerful, deserves scrutiny and deserves tighter regulation. But let's not pretend that the media in Australia is disconnected from what we're seeing. Mm-hmm. My personal experience has been, and from the interviews that I've done with people looking at this issue, there is a direct link between when the media decides to target someone and the online trolling suffered by that person. And there's a really obvious example that I'm sure people here are familiar with, Yasmin Abdul-Majid, who became a target of a national hate campaign orchestrated by the Murdoch media. That was the start of it. It wasn't people on Twitter saying that they wanted to kill her and rape her and telling her to go back to where she came from. It was started in Holt Street by professional journalists wearing suits who decided to ruin her life. That then gave succor and encouragement to online trolls. My own experience has been the same. Every single time Andrew Bolt, Tim Blair, The Australian write an article about me, like my life can be relatively troll-free for weeks and even months, and then they will write an article about me and it flares up again. They are the people who hit the go button on this sort of stuff. So there is a very tight connection between those two things.
Let's talk more about something you've both mentioned, which is police responsibility in this. Osman, in your background briefing, I think one of the big takeaways is how ill-equipped state police especially seem to be at even understanding the infrastructure, the digital infrastructure that you're even talking about. What was that experience like for you? What are next steps?
So I went to the police. I wasn't really sure when this happened to me, when I received these threats, what to do about it. I hadn't really heard about the police taking this sort of stuff seriously. But I was encouraged by the ABC, where I was working to work at the time, and friends and family to report this sort of stuff because, you know, someone sends you a message or calls you up and says they're going to kill you. You don't know if that's real or not. Like, it might not be, but it also might be. So I went to the police. The police, they didn't understand the difference between Facebook and Twitter as a starting point. They didn't understand why I would be upset and concerned by the nature of the messages I was getting. And as I did my investigation, I found that that was a pattern across, across the police forces, across Australia. And it partly has to do with there being one law written back in 2004 that's a federal Commonwealth offence that talks about using a carriage service to menace, harass and offend, which is kind of the catch-all law that police can use and very rarely do use.
They're increasingly using it.
Sure. Countries like New Zealand, Germany have passed much more sophisticated laws that acknowledge how the internet works in this day. Think about what the internet was like in 2004. Twitter didn't exist. Facebook hadn't opened yet in Australia. It was a completely different world. The idea that we don't have legislation that acknowledges that Facebook and Twitter are real entities seems bizarre to me. The other side of the police, which is not really about the online element, is the hate crime element of it. So there's a sense of police not understanding the internet and how that works. And I think there's also a problem with the police not understanding that we are living in an era where hate crime is on the rise and that we need to think about it differently till we think about other crime. You mentioned Cronulla, Ben. The 2 years after Cronulla, the New South Wales Police launched a team called the Bias Crime Investigative Unit, and their job was to make sure that they were monitoring and making sure that far-right white supremacist organisations weren't targeting people of colour, Muslims. That organisation had 4 employees. Now it has 1. So over the past decade, whilst hate crime targeting Jewish Australians, Muslim Australians has skyrocketed, and we're seeing the real-world evidence of it here, Australian police forces have withdrawn their resources investigating those kinds of crimes. My colleague Hagar Cohen has just published a background briefing story this week looking at the lack of hate crime recording in Australia and the pressure that police face from politicians to actively not record hate crime incidents. So if we don't record hate crime and we don't understand how the internet works, the chances of us dealing with the connection of those two things, which is stuff that Janine and I and a lot of other people have experienced, seems very slim.
Mm. We've been talking about the police, we've been talking about the government. Let's talk about the media now, a realm in which we all work, which has the capacity to both harm us and yet we work within this industry as well. Janine, thinking about Christchurch especially, I'm kind of struck that this was a massacre where the accused gunman in his manifesto essentially wrote a trolling document. Mm. And in the aftermath of the massacre, New Zealand has placed limits on the ways in which that document can be disseminated. And even now, as the accused killer is going to trial, the five major New Zealand media organisations have basically placed voluntary guidelines out there to say, these are the ways in which we're going to limit the capacity for this guys, white supremacist ideals to seep out into the community. Mm. So guidelines, I would say, that are probably similar to guidelines that the media has in place to minimise community harm when it comes to family violence and suicide. Now they're creating guidelines when it comes to white supremacy. And one of the guidelines is not disseminating the document at all. Another one is making sure that only senior journalists are assigned to the cases. There are quite a few bullet points there. From what you've seen of what New Zealand's doing, what's your hunch? Is that a response that's correct? And is it one that Australia should be emulating? Or does it have the capacity to stifle free speech and accurate, fair, robust reporting?
So, yeah, I think we should be emulating what these New Zealand media organisations did. And in the wake of the terror attack, a few members from the Media Diversity Australia organisation and the media union, and I mentioned this yesterday at the populism talk, so if you're hearing it again, sorry. But we put together a talk or a forum to talk about how hate speech and these terror attacks should be reported in the wake of them happening. And we had a few people from different media outlets. We didn't have anyone from News Corp. We extended the invitation, and initially they wanted to come on board, and then they retracted. And I guess the purpose of that was to try and create some kind of guideline as to how we can go forward. But for some reason, I guess Australian media organisations and people at the helm seem obsessed with this idea, and it keeps being peddled that it's going to stifle free speech. But the thing is, it's quite nuanced, because you can't platform, we've seen this quite a bit, platforming white supremacists, for example, without any critical interviewing or hard-hitting
right.
sort of reporting.
So which is where that kind of New Zealand idea of making sure senior journalists are assigned to the story to make sure that there's robust analysis rather than a simple she said, he said.
But I think we need to go further, because there are senior journalists here who have had interviews with people who are very suspect, who uphold and help embolden white supremacists, for example, who tend to get quite a bit of an easy ride. And I was saying this yesterday, there is no, think of, another extremist equivalent from another group. Do they get the airtime and the airwaves that a lot of these white supremacists do, like Blair Cottrell on Sky News? Mm. And Pauline Hanson, I mean, granted, yes, she's a politician, but she was on Dancing with the Stars, and
Not many politicians are on Sunrise every day.
Well, yeah, so
Osman, what's your take on it? Because I brought this conversation up on Twitter, which, had a really interesting response from all kinds of reporters. Gay Alcorn and Jeff Sparrow, who write for and or contribute to The Guardian, I was engaging with them, and they said that they like the idea of guidelines, but the particular guideline of not reporting on the White Supremacist Manifesto rubbed them the wrong way, because, if anything, we need to understand fascism more, and there is an argument to be made that some right-wing parties actually have a lot of overlap with the manifesto and that should be analysed. I mean, what's your take on that kind of
argument? Yeah, it's a really good one. Like, I've sort of flipped between these two things. I think there was a moment maybe a decade ago where the social relevancy of the far right was so limited that I didn't see the value in not only talking about them, but talking about them on national platforms and talking about them on television. In a way, I feel like it's a chicken and egg thing. We sort of, what came first? Talking about the far right or the far right becoming powerful that we had to start talking about them? But now, you know, we've got Pauline Hanson in Parliament, we've got Fraser Anning in Parliament, we've got people killing Muslims and Jewish people, you know, by the dozens around the world. To not talk about them doesn't seem like a solution.
Like to suddenly not report on Fraser Anning doesn't seem to be the key to necessarily deactivating him out of Parliament.
I think there's a difference between how, like, it's not as though it's a binary between not reporting and reporting. And Janine was getting to this point. It's like, you can do an interview a million different ways. And I think what we've seen in Australia is when it comes to the far right in particular, an unwillingness or perhaps just a lack of skill and knowledge amongst journalists to know how to ask these kinds of questions.
Where does that lack of skill and knowledge come from? What accounts for that void?
Racism in it, though, isn't there? Like, if these guys weren't white, I think you'd have a really different response.
If the
white supremacists, like the Christchurch killer, weren't white and they were doing death threats back in 2016, you would have had the police doing more, you know.
Compare
how someone who is an Islamic hate preacher is interrogated as they should be by the media versus how someone like Blair Cottrell is. They're very, very different things.
The manifesto is an incredible document because it's actually a predator trolling document. He really went out to do what the trolls call media fuckery, which is to use the media to propagate his own ideas. And he did it brilliantly. I mean, the Daily Mail published that document wholesale. And, you know, they really have a case to answer because that document would bring lots and lots of people to that ideology. He did the same thing in his Facebook Live video. He signaled to his cohort with all kinds of memes and language that would have brought people to those ideologies. So, you know, I mean, I'm not saying we shouldn't report on them. I've talked to those guys all through my book, but you cannot give them a free platform. And there definitely is something that links into politics here. Like, I wrote an editorial the day after the Christchurch massacre saying you cannot dehumanize certain segments of the population and expect that they won't come to harm. There is, you know, I'm from a Holocaust background. Hate crimes don't start with murder. They start with hate speech. And you have had Scott Morrison and Peter Dutton using very thinly veiled white supremacist ideologies for a very long time. The trolls take notice of that. They pay attention to that. They love people like Donald Trump. And then you get the Christchurch massacre. And why are we amazed about that? We have the leaders of our countries giving these guys permission for this. You know, and we are not, as journalists, holding them to account for it.
No, and I think, in fact, as journalists, a lot of us or a lot of journalists have done the opposite. In the aftermath of Christchurch, the national security reporter for The Australian, Paul Maley, said, this has nothing to do with Australia. We don't need to interrogate anything in Australia. This is some guy who went to Europe and learned all of this stuff there. We now know he was a paid-up member of the United Patriots Front, an Australian far-right group. He was watching Blair Cottrell on ABC television and publicly posting about how enthusiastic he was about that. So this person was, so the journalist, the national security reporter at the last broadsheet in this country was telling Australians the completely wrong thing about what was going on here.
What do you think accounts for that, or where does that come from?
Two things, I think. One is, and this is a broader thing than just national security reporting, Australian media is enormously unrepresentative of the population. Mm. And that's not to say that, like, by automatically putting in a Muslim reporter in the place of a white Australian reporter, we'd fix everything, but it is part of the problem because it means that you often in newsrooms and in production meetings, you don't have anyone who's not white saying, maybe you should ask this question, or maybe this might be a problem, or maybe actually I'm an Arabic speaker and I have some knowledge here that I might be able to help you tell a story with. That just doesn't happen in Australian newsrooms. Yeah. And then I think, like, there is not a single reporter in Australia whose job it is to report on the far right. And that is very weird.
And
to
there
me.
Is in the States.
There is
a lot
in the States,
of them
across
they're in
a bunch
my,
of news organizations.
And I also want to circle back in terms of this kind of almost latent racism that ends up in these really catastrophic events. The stuff about the police is really important. So at the very beginning of my book is a guy who is a high school shooter. He's a predator troll. He goes into a school in New Mexico and he shoots a couple of people and he shoots himself. It's very similar to the Christchurch massacre in a couple of ways, because straight after it, the local cops came out and said, "We had no idea. He doesn't even have a parking ticket." The trolls sent me a file on that guy that was thousands of documents where he had been talking for years about doing a high school shooting, and he loved the Columbine massacre. He was radicalized from the far right. He hated black people. He hated women. He hated LGBT. It's all online. Thousands and thousands of documents. They weren't looking. And this is the same with the Christchurch killer. They weren't looking. They are not, those boards, 8chan, where I've seen all the screenshots from the Christchurch killer. I've seen the stuff he wrote on Twitter. It was all there. He was radicalized. He told people what he was going to do. He was encouraged by the cohort. Why the hell are the police? I mean, I am not a techie person. I can find that stuff. It's not on the dark web. You could go there right now and find it. Okay, so if I can find it, they can find it. So I don't understand why they're not looking in those places. Same happened after the Christchurch massacre. Oh, we had no idea. But it was there. At least 2 days beforehand, he put on Twitter all his weapons. He told everybody.
He posted pictures of the mosques that he shot on Facebook 2 days before. We knew what was going to happen. And
the other thing is that the social media companies are culpable in this. Like, I went to Facebook 6 months ago, more than that now, and I said, Facebook Live is dangerous. You put this product out, and there are very similar products on the market where people have been raped, killed, shot live on those products, like Periscope. Why have you got this product? And they said to me, it's safe. And then the Christchurch massacre happened, and we know that that was all broadcast on Facebook. So, I mean, why do we believe them when so many catastrophic things are happening? Like, they have created this public place where we are coming to grave harm, and nobody is holding them to account. I just find it absolutely extraordinary. Like, can you imagine putting a car on the road that you knew people were going to get killed, and we just went, no worries, it doesn't matter that that product's not safe. It's very hard to understand why we just let them go. Like, as publishers, other publishers can't do that.
Well, let's talk about those responsibilities and segue into the concept of duty of care. So each of you work within a world where I think, like, almost sadly, is it safe to say that it's probably expected that if you are a woman or someone from someone from a minority background, you will experience this if you engage in public discourse. So with that in mind, for instance, Janine, as you've worked for different media organisations, as a young Palestinian background, Muslim background woman working within this realm, what have employers done to help and protect you, and where do you think that duty of care lies?
It's a tough question to unpack. My employers, at The Australian, for example, when they knew of what was happening, because I couldn't really hide it anymore, I was sent out on a few stories with a security guard. So they weren't proactive measures. It was in reaction to what already happened.
What would a proactive measure look like? Or have you thought about what represents best duty
honestly,
of care or best practice?
Well, the thing is, for me, and going back to what Oz was saying, it's structural, really. There needs to be more diversity within newsrooms, for example. Is your question related to, like, as a journalist being trolled,
as we're having this question, I do start questioning myself, actually, because you're right in that a lot of the conversation we're having is structural, but at the same time, there is an individual personal dimension where you still need to operate in a practical realm while doing your job.
Janine.
That's okay. When I was at the ABC, something else had sort of transpired, and I was offered counselling, and I took it up, but I also felt that with the therapist that was recommended to me, and I saw her twice, just really didn't understand where I was coming from. And perhaps that's just not understanding some of those identity questions, really. I've never really been fussed about what my employer can do for me. I've never really thought about it in that way.
You wouldn't change the shape of how things are structured in the first place.
Yeah, because I've always just sort of, I take it on the chin and I'm going to push forward. So, yeah, for me, it's more a question of, you know, some of the stories that I was sent out on as a junior reporter, as well, some of the door knocks that I had to do, I did feel sort of at risk. I mean, there was so many stories that I don't really want to unpack here in front of everyone, but I was put in dangerous situations. I was put in a situation where there was somebody who was essentially trying to groom me to go overseas, to Syria. I was a junior reporter. I had no idea what was happening. I really wanted to play to my strengths, given my background, the fact that I speak Arabic. But yeah, I think media outlets in general, whether it's the Oz, whether, you know, News Corp, ABC, there's a lack of transparency about what goes on. And the decisions that are made in newsrooms as well. The news that we consume is reflective of the people in charge and the ideas that they have and the way that they see the world.
It's not a neutral thing, it's values-based.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't know if that answers your question, but...
That does. And we'll go to audience questions soon. Yeah. But before we do, Oz, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, I think there's a... I think Janine's experiences are fascinating and complex. And I think there's a tension that's always kind of been there in journalism, but perhaps it feels real now given the stakes are so much higher on all of these things. But I think there's another paradox, which is that the way that media works in 2019, media organisations benefit from their journalists having big profiles, big social media profiles, being personalities, being engaged in the cut and thrust of social, cultural, political debate, but they don't always think about what the consequences for that those journalists are. And I think some of them are starting to. I can only really talk from my experiences. The ABC has got trauma, resilience people, it's got security stuff that helped me navigate these kinds of things. I know in America, news organizations are starting to employ people whose job it is to basically monitor the social media accounts of their employees. So it says, we benefit from you having 100,000 Twitter followers and 80,000 Instagram followers, but you're going to cop so much garbage. If you see that, that will impact your mental health and we're going to take that away from you. And it does impact your mental health. Like, I have spent thousands of dollars on therapy, on medication to deal with the psychological distress of this stuff. And the end result of that is I'm just not on Twitter anymore. I built up an audience of 25,000 people. I got job opportunities through that. I'm no longer in that space. I have a security guard at these events now as a consequence of this stuff. That's all real world impacts of these things that I think media organizations should be thinking through more as they tell their journalists to go out there and do reporting.
Can I just jump in really quickly? I just want to say two things. One is that I have been arguing for a long time for social media self-defense training. So any organizations that have people online, they have social media policies that protect the risk of the company, but they don't, as Osman's saying, protect the person. So I now have huge government departments coming to me begging me because their people are copying so much cyber hate and it's so damaging. And there's a social media lawyer quoted in my book, his name is Roger Blow, and he's saying companies are going to get sued for trauma and the claims from employees are going to succeed if they don't protect staff in some way. So that's a really important economic thing, but also you can see from hearing people's stories the distress. And just very quickly on the distress and the kind of destruction of people's lives, one of the things that started happening when I started reporting on this stuff all the time is people would write to me and their lives were destroyed, like they lost jobs, they had to move house, they had to go to court, all this stuff. And I realised it was costing people a lot of money and I thought, you know what, this is going to shut the conservatives up who keep saying, you're a snowflake, stay off the internet if I can get the money. So I commissioned the Australian Institute to do nationally representative polling and what we came up with was astounding. So 44% of adult Australian women have copped some kind of cyber abuse and 39% of men. It's 8.8 million Australians. And when we talk about the extreme predator trolling, it's 1.3 million Australians that have copped this extreme stuff. That's the same amount of people that have a hearing loss or have ever tried ICE, right? It's a lot of people. This isn't a mild thing. The cost of cyber hate is $3.7 billion. And it's just, that is just time off work and medical costs. all right? So it's a drop in the ocean. If you think about the costs of the police, the cost of the security guards, all that stuff. So we need to stop thinking that this is virtual. It's very real. It costs a lot of money and it has a human cost as well.
Thank you so much for that, Ginger. That's really, really fascinating. We're going to take audience questions now. We've got about 10 minutes. So if you raise your hand up high, if you've got a comment, save it for the sign desk where you'll be buying Ginger's book. But for now, questions with a question mark. We've got one right back there and we'll start with you. And was there a second question at all? And one up right in the front row as well. We'll go in the back row first. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for the talk. That was amazing. I had a quick question. I don't want to take away from the amazing work that people of colour do in terms of activism here in Australia and around the world, but what was your thoughts on Egg Boy, and is there a role for, like, trolling for good?
Well, first of all, so Egg Boy in the aftermath of Christchurch and Fraser Anning's comments, Egg Boy, young teenager who egged a senator, was captured on camera. What were your thoughts?
Look, there's definitely a place for trolling for good. I would never say that, and I would never want people to not have a voice online. And I know this is going to be unpopular. It's not what most of my colleagues online think. But trolls are sadists, and they want to hurt and upset you, right? And I don't think an eye for an eye is going to solve this. I don't think you can fight hatred with hatred. And, you know, it's why I went in and talked to the trolls with radical empathy, and people disagree with that. But you cannot solve hate with more hate. So I don't agree that violence is the answer to violence. We need something else here. And what happened when I went in and talked to the trolls with radical empathy is that they changed me and I changed them, and some of them are no longer trolling anymore because of that. So, no. Do I think you should have done it? No, I don't. I don't agree with Fraser Anning and the horrible things he said, but should we be violent back? I mean, it's not the Old Testament, you know. Hopefully we're not devolving. I don't want us devolving. I want us evolving into more compassionate humans.
I did find the conversation after Egg Boy happened to be quite interesting. A lot of the discussion questioning what constituted violence, whether an egging was violent and whether it did come from a place of hate. Where did the two of you arrive on Egg Boy?
I actually tried not to think about it too much. I just thought, and I think Egg Boy sort of said it best himself. He, when he did the project interview, said, I actually just feel really sad that this has become such a big focus of the debate and taken away from the victims. And I think, look, that's my general view. But that said, it's probably always worth interrogating, how do you fight back against the far right? What is, like, is throwing an egg or smashing an egg on someone's face equivalent to Anning's views? So is it like, you know, we're all on the same page here? I can't remember who it was. Someone wrote a really fascinating, might have been Jason Wilson for The Guardian. He just explored the history of egging in Australian political culture. And that was interesting because it kind of reminded us that, like, this is Australia and this is politics. Like, people sometimes get pies chucked in their face. Like, I think John Huston got an egg thrown at him and he caught it and threw it back or whatever. Like, this is, that's just, like, part and parcel in a way. And it's not necessarily good. I'm not endorsing throwing eggs at politicians at all. But, like, compare how we seem to have used to have dealt with this stuff to now being, like, this 17-year-old kid is, like, this violent criminal who we need to discuss and debate for months. Fraser Anning's goons at a press conference a couple of weeks ago physically beat up a journalist. Mm. To me, that's a real violent act, and we're not talking about that anywhere near as much as we're talking about Egg Boy. And what does that say about the media and Australian society?
Mm. Janine, any thoughts before the next question?
Yeah, echoing what Oz said, it wasn't something I gave much thought to because it was just in the wake of what happened, and I just felt like the unpacking and almost obsessive discussion about it online was really derailing what we should have been talking about.
Yeah.
Ultimately, I mean, I feel like the people that I had spoken to and many people from the Muslim community felt like, I mean, they love Egg Boy. They loved Egg Boy. They loved what he did. They actually felt like for the first time ever, really, somebody actually took a stand for them. You know, I guess in front of cameras, for example, when you see interviews and you see, you know, media outlets platforming the likes of Fraser Anning without much interrogation, for that to happen, it's sort of like, well, you know, finally something's happened. But yeah, I think there was also an issue with And I think this is something that really troubles me within, I suppose, the Australian media industry. This discussion about, I guess, what's polite. And instead of seeing the fact that, you know, Fraser Anning and, you know, his ilk have incited violence against Muslims and people of colour. But there was this like real obsession with, you know, being polite and being civil. And I mentioned this yesterday as well, and I think it's pertinent. After the Christchurch attack, my dad was walking to the grocery store, and it was near the mosque near my parents' place. And somebody was driving down the road and swerved and veered to just like startle my dad. And then caught something out and then just sped off. And my dad lives with, you know, they live in a very Middle Eastern area in Western Sydney. And it was just this white bloke coming through who almost ran my dad over, and he stumbled back. And we're talking about the impact of an egg. Like, come on. You know, I'm sure he survived it. That's all I'm going to say. I'm just, yeah.
Thank you for your question, and thank you, panel, for that as well. There was a question at the front.
Thank you for offering your personal narratives for the collective benefit of this audience today and learning more about trolling. I guess I have a visionary question. And the first is, what type of educational framework can respond to really the deep root causes of prejudice? So what would be the attributes of this educational framework to respond to the deep-rooted causes of trolling online? And the second is, how would you describe the online sphere, the ideal attributes of the online sphere?
Okay. Ginger, do you want to start?
I don't have a whole program in mind, but that there is a crucial intervention point for predator trolls that get radicalised, which is, you know, they shouldn't be brought up by the internet. I mean, they are not parented at all, those kids. And actually, like, when Meepsheep explained his violent alcoholic mother and the, you know, his father had starved him and had been brought up on the internet, imbibing that misogynist white supremacist ideology, I totally got it. I mean, that's a parenting story, right? And we can fix that. So I think that's quite straightforward in a way. What was the second part of your question?
The ideal attributes of the online experience, so, online space.
The internet, I went to a talk at ANU by the father of the internet. He made the internet, this guy, Vint Cerf. And it was incredible listening to his vision about how we'd all been connected, much like what Ben was saying at the beginning, you know, that we'd all have a voice and we'd all be knowledgeable and so forth. And now what we've got is this kind of cesspit, and it's dangerous and it harms us. And I mean, I don't think we can afford to let that happen. This is a kind of crucial emergency where we need to take back that ideology. And it's not very hard. Like, I was on the drum talking about trolling, and your woman, she was from the Diversity Council, she was getting hysterical about censorship on the internet. I mean, it's actually very simple. The norms that apply in everyday life have to apply online. And I keep saying this, and actually the politicians have started saying it too, which is great. You cannot harass me at work. You cannot say to me you're going to cut my uterus out and kill my kids in the supermarket, but you can online. Why? You know, actually, it's just got to be the same. Your free speech ends when it harms me. Full stop. And all the same stuff applies. I don't think it's brain surgery. I think it's very simple.
Thoughts from Janine and Oz about, you know, an educational framework and or ideal online experiences in that space?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of an educational framework, it's not something that I, you know, have given much thought to, because I feel like it's so much bigger than me, and it's really hard to sort of sit down and try and imagine something. But
at the same time, you're having a conversation about educating the media, though.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that goes back to the need for more diversity in newsrooms in terms of class, different backgrounds. And also, I mean, some of these things are very, like, not even structural within Australian newsrooms. So, for example, some of the trolling that I get is very, like, vehemently anti-Palestinian. You know, Palestine, like, just like Palestinians don't exist, and just like a barrage of, you know, threats and abuse that I receive. But that's something that's sort of beyond my control, really. It's a discussion that we can have in the newsroom. That's something that goes back to, you know, it's an on the ground situation with the occupation that's taking place. And the thing is, because I sort of, you know, I really own my identity, and the fact that I'm the daughter of, you know, two Palestinian refugees really seems to upset a lot of people. And, you know, there was an article that somebody had written about me after the rape and murder of the young woman in Melbourne recently, Ayema Sadwe. So she was a Palestinian citizen of Israel. And I wrote a story about how Australian media was essentially erasing her identity. So it's this sort of thing where, like, I'm writing something and I'm getting a response back. I'm losing my train of thought, but I had written that piece saying that, you know, she's Palestinian, they identify as Palestinian, and that's really important. And someone wrote an article saying that I'm calling for the destruction of Israel, and I'm litigating against that particular article. I don't know how much I can say, only because I've been experiencing this for so many years, and I just felt like this was my opportunity to actually do something. And what ended up happening was this article was posted. It was reposted by old mate Avi Yemeni. So it reached, you know, his Australian audiences. And again, I was just receiving, you know, really disgusting stuff that also happens to be sexist. I once received this comment a couple of years ago, and it's very mild and banal. But, I mean, it's me. But someone was saying, you know, Janine's not a journalist, she's just a belly dancer with a press card. And so that delegitimizing of my job as a reporter. So,
that's not that necessarily the online ideal online experience.
It's not.
Kind of the opposite.
I can't really envision something positive. I know that sounds really cynical and negative.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I feel like, yes, there need to be improvements to how we, you know, operate online. But being on Twitter, people are like, log off. But it's also given me a platform to talk about things that are really important to me that I would otherwise never have had the opportunity to talk about or highlight, you know, my family story, for example, which is really important to me. Yeah.
Thank you. We're out of time, but Oz, just quickly, one final contribution from you.
I don't really feel super optimistic. Like, I think when I first was on Twitter about a decade ago, it was a nicer space. I made friends. I met up with people that I met on Twitter. I got offered opportunities to write different articles. And I don't know whether Twitter has gotten worse or social media has gotten worse, or perhaps it's just become more reflective of something that's happening in society as well. And to link that back to your education question, I think it's, like, I hope that there may be a way to educate young people so that when they get older, they don't hold prejudicial views. But, you know, anti-Muslim views, anti-women views aren't taught to people in schools. They come from somewhere else. And they are now being reflected on the internet. And I honestly don't think, even, and this goes back to what I said at the start, we should, and I hope we do, create laws specifically to deal with online abuse. But I still think that's just dealing with a symptom. I don't know how we deal with the lack of social cohesion we have now in our society and in so many societies. But we need to deal with it, because until we do, we're still going to see all of these problems emerge online and in the real world.
Radical empathy.
Yeah. Thank you very much, panel. Thank you for your question as well. Yes, could you please join me in thanking our wonderful panel, Ginger, Osman and Janine.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe and rate our channel.